Coming up on this episode of the Star Wars Report podcast, it's Darth Maul himself, Sam Witwer, joins us, as well as the Rogue One composer replaced and more controversy. Let's talk about it right now. If there was a podcast that had, I don't know, two, not one, but two interviews with Star Wars Rebels stars premiering this weekend, as well as news and commentary you've come to expect, as well as highlights of the John Williams panel at Dragon Con. Well, there is, and you've tuned into it. It's the Star Wars Report podcast, episode 240. I'm your host, Riley Blanton. Thank you so much for joining us. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Please delete as appropriate. You're home. Welcome. It is the Star Wars Report. And man, do we have a jam-packed show. Not only that, like Adam Driver's talking about episode 8 and how it's similar to The Empire Strikes Back, but not in the way you think. And is Han Solo force sensitive? We got all kinds of things. Your emails and much more. It's all coming up on the Star Wars Report. Let's bring them in. Let's go straight to it. Punch it, Chewie. It's Mr. Mark Herleman. How's it going, Mark?
Riley. We're home.
How are we doing?
Actually, that would be a great way to do it. Hey, how's it going? Hey, how's it going, guys? We're home. Honey, I'm home. Can you imagine? Talk about an alternate universe where it's just like Leia's like, you're late.
What would have been is like Chewie would have turned for a second after Han to, Chewie, we're home. I turned it off. I turned it off. I told you, I turned it off.
That's a throwback. Turn it off. All right. And also, let's not forget him. He's the producer of this fine program and, of course, host of Literary Treks at Trek FM, and he's talking Star Wars here with us this week. It's Mr. Bruce Gibson.
Honey, I'm home. Yeah!
Dude, how's life?
Life is pretty good, except I think all the blood in my body is going towards my stomach because I ate, like, so much Mexican food.
Oh,
I'm just, like, wearing down right now.
I feel like that Carillion food is very much like Mexican food. But enough about that. We won't
yes,
dwell on that too long.
Mexican
gentlemen,
food.
Literally, just now, I kid you not, as we record this, this is a life-threatening endeavor, this week's episode of the Star Wars Report. Because outside the window, where I sit now, and I have these serious, like, noise-canceling headphones that I have in the studio upstairs. And I literally just looked out the window and saw the biggest lightning strike ever. And even through the noise-canceling headphones, this boom. I don't know if the mic picked it up. But man, I feel like this should be like,
we've intercepted it. Like a host of Jango Fett's here to create a clone army.
Yes,
I feel like that's what I should be saying.
I was going to say this is the perfect weather for you to make some clones.
Exactly. One of my favorite themes, by the way, in Attack of the Clones, underrated. The whole do 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 do. All right, but we'll get music of John Williams and more is coming up. Let's not beat around the bush though. Let's go straight into it. We have two interviews, not one but two, that I want to highlight for you guys this week, and we're just going to go straight into them right up front because Star Wars Rebels returns this Saturday to the small screen on Disney Channel, and we were fortunate enough to be attending. Bruce, you were with us. Celebration Europe. And there we had the opportunity to do the press day, and I thought we could have put out the interviews then, but I actually wanted to savor these because, man, they're good. Do you want to hear Sam Witwer kind of light into the whole Legends thing? Well, you're going to, because that's what's about to happen, gentlemen. And also Tia Sirkar gets into the character of Sabine and her expanded role. So that's your tease. Let's get straight into it. It's Sam Witwer live on the ground at Star Wars Celebration Europe talking Star Wars Rebels Season 3.
Sam,
hey.
So good to see you. I'm Riley.
How's
it's good
it going?
To see you.
Yeah,
going fantastic. You doing all right today?
Yeah.
Good,
so far,
good.
So good.
Man, so we were in the hallway, not even the hallway, the giant, giant theater watching the trailer to Season 3 of Star Wars Rebels. There's so many questions.
Mm-hmm.
So many.
I'll give you all of the
yes,
answers.
Exactly. I just want to start with talk us through your process with playing the character of Maul, because you're someone who I have enormous respect for with how much you are into the mythology of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear your thoughts on the evolution of the characters from the Clone War all the way to now.
Right.
Because with Clone Wars, we saw a very different Maul, but I feel like even again in Rebels, we're seeing a very different Maul.
Yes, and Dave and I continually talk about that. I mean, the thing with Darth Maul is in any of these dark side characters, is that you're not just playing a character, as you are embodying a theology. You're presenting the values against which the heroes are struggling. That's the whole thing.
And what is that theology from Maul?
Fear. It's what the dark side is about. When we first presented Darth Maul in the Clone Wars, what we were trying to do is we were doing Star Wars Goes to Hell, basically.
Yeah.
That they go into this
quite
deep
literally.
Cave. Quite literally, there's fire, there's flame, and he is this in this garbage web, and he's this spider creature who's hissing and babbling to himself. And he regains his composure later and finally becomes a little bit more of the Sith Lord that we remember from The Phantom Menace. But the objective that we had, and that I thought we had an opportunity to show, what is Darth Vader dealing with underneath the mask? What kind of madness does that guy experience and deal with? And he chokes it down so that he can say, you know, you don't know the power of the dark side.
Yeah.
But what are his private moments like? Well, Darth Maul, when we found him in the Clone Wars, he did not have the strength to hold that stuff back, and it had consumed him. It had made garbage stick to him and formed spider legs. All this awful thing, all this awfulness was happening. So that was the most raw that I think we will ever see the character.
Yeah.
But from there, we piece by piece tried to build up the psychology of the character who has that inside.
Yes, and we see such a different Maul in season 2 and now even season 3.
Well, and there's a lot of there's quite a bit of personality to him this time around. I mean, he's about 50, 60 years old at this point, you know.
Yeah.
He moisturizes, so he looks really good. But he's gone through a lot. He's been through a lot, and he's even quite different than the Darth Maul that took over Mandalore, you know.
Yes.
He's, you know, oh, previous lion, does, you know, he tells the Mandalorians what to do, and he's very controlled and it's like a statesman. Now he's like this kindly old man who wants nothing more than to rob you blind and burn down your house.
He's just sharing some knowledge.
Yeah,
just a few
right.
helpful tips.
Well,
for
and
Ezra.
That's now here's the other thing about Darth Maul, though, is that we do play with the idea that on some level he understands sincerity. He understands what it means to love someone and to lose someone, and we've seen it happen on the Clone Wars with his brother Savage, played by Clancy Brown.
Yes.
And I think that there is a need for him to find a brother, to have a brother, to have someone that he is close to.
Yeah.
Because as we learned in the Clone Wars, and we did it a little bit subtly, but he always called.
Frankly, that's what gave him that dimension to
that's
begin
right.
with. Yeah.
Well, I just love that in the Clone Wars, for example, the same thing that he did to Obi-Wan, where he kills Qui-Gon Jinn in front of him, happened to him.
Yes.
And the first thing that he says when we find him in the cave is he's mumbling, talking about how mercy is a lie. And the last thing we saw from him in Clone Wars was him begging for mercy. I mean, these were all moves we were making very consciously. And so now we have a character who's been through all that, who's reflected on all that.
Yes.
And so he's unpredictable, because where does he land on that scale at this point? Having learned all that he's learned.
Yes.
Where is he? Because you can't tell me that someone could have pulled the wool over Ezra's eyes so completely with sincerity and not on some level have meant what he was saying about,
you do get that
come
sense.
Join me and I just want to help, and we need to do this because the galaxy is in shambles and we can help. We can
and
do
that
this.
Kind of that layer of characterization is something that Star Wars Rebels does so well that we're so much looking forward to season 2. I got one parting question for you, because we can talk Maul all day, but I want to get your thoughts. Sam, the guy who played the West End games, the kid who's loved this saga for so long, Thrawn in Star Wars Rebels. I want to get your thoughts on it. Because you were on stage watching it.
Yeah, that's been a secret I've had to keep for a while.
Yes.
But I'm very, very excited. Because here's the thing, nothing has changed. Everyone thinks that the Legends thing in the EU, it's the expanded universe, now it's Legends. Oh, everything, the world is falling apart, the sky is falling, what are we going to do? It's chaos.
Yes. Do you want to do it?
And it's the same thing. It's the same thing as it's always been. When George was working on the Clone Wars with Dave, there was never the expectation that TV show or George's movies was going to line up one for one with the expanded universe materials. Those West End Games books are largely still accurate. The ones that were written in the 80s, they're largely still accurate with the world. But there are things that they get wrong all the time in terms of what we, you know, what Star Wars later did. So this notion that everything needs to line up is just so funny to me because for two reasons. One, take Marvel. Mm-hmm. There's no expectation for the Marvel movies and the comic books to line up. For things to reflect each other, yes. But for them to line up, no. You know, take Star Trek. Star Trek had an expanded universe years ago. I don't know if people remember this, but there was Final Reflection and all these books that were written by John Ford. I think it was Ford. And all these role-playing game materials. None of it is accurate anymore. It's all gone. Gene Roddenberry liked that stuff, but he didn't use any of it. Now, George and Dave did go into the comic books and did look around and say, let's grab this guy, let's grab that guy, let's do this, let's do that. George looked at Asajj Ventress and goes, we should take that character and make her a main character. And,
absolutely. Yeah.
So when people think that there's a big difference now that it's Legends, it's just a different name.
Well,
it's
and the
always
important...
the same thing. We're still dipping in, grabbing ideas. When we were doing Darth Maul, we made the Sith Code canon.
Yeah, you had fragments of it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Suddenly, guess what? We've just brought that in. So.
And that's the important thing, because I know you're so busy, but that's so true. And the characters is what makes the difference.
That's
just having a character like Thrawn, characters like Darth Maul show up, that's what makes this series so special. Sam, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
There it is. There it is.
Sam. You could see the bouncer behind you when that was going down. You're like, we gotta wrap this up. This lady's gonna kill me, man. Sam, you're gonna get me killed.
You have no idea. You have no idea.
He was ready to keep going, but you're like, dude, I cherish my life. I want to come back next year and do this again, please. Sam, like, don't blow this for me.
That's literally basically. Oh, that's sorry. I had my mic muted there for a second. Yeah, no, that's literally. That's literally what I was thinking, pretty much. I was kind of terrified, and also like we were on that. I'm not gonna beat around. We were on that press line kind of last minute, and so we were super lucky and blessed to actually have that opportunity at all. And like there were a ton of people in that line, and so Sam was super generous with his time and stuff. My big takeaway, like I loved what he had to say about like two things. One, the poetry of Maul, like the idea of him, the first scene we ever see him in the Clone Wars when he first returns in the spider form is he's like, you know, mercy is a lie. But then the last scene we see him in is he's begging for mercy. Like, that was super poetic. I never thought about that.
I liked what he had to say about Legends because, I mean, you know, we've been saying it for the longest time. You know, the story group's basically George Lucas bringing things from the expanded universe into canon just like it always did. You know, I mean, that has never changed. You know, that's the one aspect. I do point out, you know, while Legends changed dramatically, that aspect's never changed. So, you know, we were talking on Twitter about characters that have made that jump, and there has always been a small list. But, I mean, think about it. You have Quinlan Vos, you have Aaliyah Secura. They came from comics into the films. You've got Snap, who came recently from recent books. You've got Leonis from Rebels, who was designed for that. But there was very, very few. And now we have Thrawn, who really is the only one that came from the EU, you know, the Legends universe over.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
granted,
here he is.
Know,
and I love, like,
did came from earlier, way earlier.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I love, and I think that's, it's a good, it is a significant addition. Like, including the Sith code, that's cool. It's not on the level of including Thrawn. So I think there is something special about it, but the process has been there for a long time. And I'm glad that process is still taking place.
Well, and like he said about the West End Games material, I mean, you know, like we've mentioned before, Tarkin's name coming over, I mean, that came from Legends. There's a lot of those things that those RPG games helped, you know, make a foundation for Legends that will always continue to be there, which is cool.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's so much gold. So much gold.
Well, he can talk all day. I mean, it's so amazing that you find a actor within the Star Wars universe that actually gets Star Wars and on a deep level. You know, to make that connection with Maul, I mean, he doesn't even make those connections just with the characters that he does. He knows all this stuff of all the different characters that all the different actors portray. I mean, it's just incredible what a big fan, how he's into this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. you nailed it. He's a fan, and you can tell. I mean, when he's bringing up Trek, you know, he is a sci-fi fan. You and I, Bruce and Riley, we know, you know, we've read the books and stuff like that from Trek and stuff, and realized that, you know, there was no continuity there till around 90 or not 90 till around 09 and stuff. Then they finally started making the books actually line up with each other. But my dad read the early Trek stuff, and that was a nightmare. No book ever referenced each other. You'd have characters that would die that were back in the next book and stuff. My dad would go nuts. I mean, Trek for me, you know, was so broken that going to Star Wars was like, ha, 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 Dad, I don't have to deal with this chaos. What did I get myself into?
Well, because Star Wars then got too big. That's really what happened. That's what's happened with Star Trek, because there's just so much stuff. And then Star Wars is getting to be so much stuff that even Lucasfilm, I don't think, could really put themselves in that corner and keep everything consistent. So they had to kind of reset the reboot button.
Yeah.
True.
But that doesn't mean that they're willing to pull some of the best out. That's what makes me excited. I would have, if you asked me, guys, like, seriously, if you asked me a year ago, even when Rebels was already on the air, if they were going to bring in Thrawn or Mara Jade or something like that, I would have been like, no way that happens. And here it's happening. But that's not the only aspect. In fact, like, there's a reason that those were the two Star Wars Rebels guests at Celebration, Sam Witwer and Tia Sirkar, because also having an expanded and ever more present role is the character of Sabine, and Tia Sirkar drops some knowledge as well. Let's take a listen to Tia. Here we go. Let me make sure I got everything queued up here. Yeah. Let's take a listen to Tia again, live on the ground at Star Wars Celebration Europe.
We gotta get it started. I'm Riley, by the way.
I'm Tia. Nice to meet you.
It is a pleasure to meet you. Man, we are such a big Rebels fan at the Star Wars Report, and it's been such a fun process seeing season one and season two, and really seeing these characters evolve. But I just want to start off straight with the season three, the trailer we just saw. We see such an evolution amongst all the characters and where they are. Talk a little bit about where Sabine is, where we left her off in season two, and now where she is now in season three.
Well, I definitely think everyone was sort of left reeling after season two and what happened with Ahsoka and Vader, and I think everyone...
Very non-manly tears on behalf of this one.
Oh my gosh.
It was hard.
Yeah, I mean, I still think about that moment at the end and you know, get goosebumps. But I think everyone sort of was shocked and needed some time. I think that's yes. maybe why we see people look different. You know, Ezra's got short hair, and Sabine, of course, Sabine changes her look at will. Yeah.
She's the innovator in this department.
Yeah, so totally. But, you know, I think that was a heavy blow to all of us. Who knows what even happened? I mean, I certainly don't. Even though I've tried to find out, it's not gonna happen. We actually had a recording session the day after the season two finale aired, and I stormed in with all kinds of questions. And of course, Dave like does that thing where he answered in such a way that I thought something was answered, and then I walked away and I was like, that was no information at all. How did he do that? Like,
he's a professional at it.
Oh, he's so good.
Hey,
he's
guys,
too good.
Sorry,
yeah.
I can't answer that.
No, but with me, he leads me down a path where I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm like getting it out of him, and then I go away and I'm like, no, he gave me nothing. But I so skillfully that I thought that he gave me more than I. Yeah, no, it's all a game. It's all like a masterful like. He's like a magician.
Exactly. He's like the friendly, smiley Palpatine, but with a really
cool
hat.
Yes.
And a dapper vest today, too, by the way.
He's looking sharp. I thought he looked great.
Absolutely.
Wait, sorry. I got off topic.
No, that's a good question.
Where were we?
No, because you briefly mentioned, I want to touch on it. You said you went straight into a recording session right after the season two finale. So I know you guys are normally, there's a pretty big delay, but as you go through the process, how aware of you are of what your character is doing, and more specifically, what's that process like of developing Sabine as a character when you're doing a recording session?
Well, in seasons one and two, I was on like a very need to know basis, and I apparently didn't need to know much because like we didn't. I mean, especially season two, I got to know a little bit more.
Yes.
And of course, Dave, nothing is by accident. I mean, he knows exactly like what he needs to tell us to get the performance that he needs from us. So he definitely gives you what you need, but nothing more. Whereas in season three, three, I feel like because Sabine has so much more to do and so much more responsibility, he's sort of like giving me more responsibility as well by like giving me a bigger picture, sort of an idea of what, like an overarching sort of what's happening now, what probably will happen.
And we're so excited for that. Like seriously, seeing Sabine's presence risen and seeing that we're going to get a lot more for in season three has us so excited. Talk a little bit broadly, anyway, of what we can expect Sabine to be facing in season three. What are you excited for and what can we possibly expect?
Well, I think Sabine definitely has a lot more responsibility this season as far as, I mean, she's sort of coming into her own more. I mean, she was always like very mature and very capable, but now she's actually sort of assuming more of a leadership position, and she's got a lot more responsibility, not just responsibility towards the Ghost crew, but now she's also got this whole Mando storyline that, you know, perhaps she has sort of responsibility in other areas of her life that she has not been sort of that haven't been a part of her life for a while.
Absolutely.
And so there's all this new new for us, you know, now like storylines that she's got people in her life that she sort of might have to answer to. I'm like so super trying to keep this vague.
No, but like without giving just even just what we're hearing now, I'm so excited to hear that we're going to get to see a little bit more dimension to the character.
Definitely.
Because that's what Rebels has done so remarkably well over time is that it's not a formulaic show. It
is,
you guys are so confident in the storytelling side and in the performance side to be different and to change things up, and that's what we look forward to.
Yeah,
Tia, thank you so much for coming on the Star Report.
Thank you.
Take care.
There it is. Tia Sirkar. I was laughing there at the end because like she was really reaching just because she knows something, right?
And she slipped you a piece of paper that said recruit me as a Both and spy, didn't she? Wait. You tell me that in the back chat. We won't say that online.
Well, I wish. No. In fact, like, I mean, but she did kind of give us a tidbit, like she might have some new people to answer to. Methinks.
Yes.
I was hoping she slipped you her phone number.
Okay, all right, Bruce. All right. No, we're true professionals. You're true professionals. But yes, no, that was Tia's the best.
Wait, let's just ask a question here though. Like, if you happen to get her phone number, would you call and be like, hey, I don't know if you remembered me, but we were talking, you know, about Star Wars Rebels, and you were still talking. Come on for an interview or something like that. Because, like, somehow, I don't know how it managed to end up on my phone, but I got Jason Swank's phone number, and I occasionally think about calling him up and go, hey, I don't know if you remember me, but we should just shoot the sheet sometime, see what's going on, talk about Sith Lord.
Mark, I want to let you know. I would know. I'm a true professional. It was a truly professional environment. We conducted our interviews. Tia handled herself with poise, class, and no small degree of charm. And it was an excellent exchange of which we are all grateful for and hope to have the opportunity to continue. So I'm going to discontinue this line of conversation and move along.
You just to wear a shirt that just says, hey, if you have any inside tips you want to tell me later, and then have your phone number. See, that's where my phone number works,
Mark, this
out.
Is why
blank Jedi.
I'm never letting any of you guys anywhere near any press stuff at celebrations ever. this is why you're gonna get me in trouble.
Yeah, we just get ourselves in trouble. We don't get you in trouble.
Yeah, exactly, because I'd be like, Bruce,
like,
who?
Who's
this guy? I don't know. Mark Hurla who? All right.
I never who? Sith Lord before.
Oh my goodness. But yeah, no, it's this Saturday, September 24th on Disney XD. Star Wars Rebels returns. I've seen. We had the opportunity to see the opening episodes at Celebration. They are absolutely incredible. Thrawn is absolutely incredible. It's Star Wars television at the best it's ever been, and we're super super excited. I'm actually gonna have a full blog post with the transcript and everything of the interviews and video of the two interviews. If you're interested in kind of catching some, I just produced together like a highlight reel of the two interviews mashed up together with some footage of Star Wars Rebels, and it's going to be in a nice YouTube video on our YouTube channel. So, yeah, no, absolutely. We're super lucky to be able to participate and that thanks to the folks at Disney and Lucasfilm for arranging all of that stuff at Celebration. It was super nice of them. Let's I feel like away from Rebels and into, well, into the news.
We have something to report.
Come closer, I have good news.
Data brought to us by the Bothan spies.
We can send a clear transmission.
There it is. Listen, listen.
Adam Driver is talking episode 8. We're getting some hints, getting some small giblets, if you will, in Collider. Collider interviewed him, and they say, how was the script? Which, by the way, it points to the subtlety of Collider. But Adam Driver said, well, Mark, I'll let you do the honors. Adam Driver said,
it's great. It's similar to how The Empire Strikes Back has a different tone. For the people that always go, ooh, it's dark, but I don't know that it necessarily is. It's just a different tone in a way that I think is great and necessary, but also very clear. He trusts that his audience is ready for a nuance and ambiguity. He's not dumbing anything down for someone, and that's really fun to play.
He's not dumbing any... That's the one quote in this story that that jumps out to me. He's not
me
dumbing anything
down.
Because
I'm curious how it jumps for you.
I feel like it feels like a comparative sentence, right? Like, it feels like by him stating so emphatically that it's not dumbing anything down, that he's sort of contrasting that maybe with the more... we'll say traditional mythological elements of The Force Awakens. Maybe he's talking about complexity. I don't know. What do you think, Bruce?
I think it's complexity. That's exactly what I'm thinking. I think that the first, well, I shouldn't say the first movie, but episode 7 of this new trilogy, I think plays it a little safe. And I think that's what he's saying here is that, you know, they're willing to take chances and they're willing not to assume that no one knows Star Wars as they're going into this, that everybody has probably seen episode 7. So there's no reason to make it too friendly to people who haven't seen Star Wars, because the assumption is that everybody that's coming into this has seen at least episode 7.
Yeah. And that episode 7 is definitely a good enough starting point. Like, I feel like I've talked to a couple kids who had never seen the original Star Wars, but did see episode 7. I feel like that was one of my many, like, lifeguard Star Wars conversations that tended to happen over the summer, many of which got recounted here on the podcast. But yeah, no, I think...
6 didn't dumb it down either, but they kind of did that replay of A New Hope that made it feel like it was repeated, even though it wasn't.
Yeah, I can
like,
see that.
So when I think dumbing down, I always think of those aspects of, like, you know, well, do we need to know this type of thing? Oh, no, the audience is that dumb. We don't need to dumb it down for them. You know, if we put that kind of out there, they're gonna get lost in the, well, why'd they put that in there kind of thing. Like, I see, you know, the whole it's dark angle. Like, that was kind of my natural assumption, is that we were going to get something darker. I was assuming that with episode 2. You know, I mean, it just had that natural feel. That's what was always classic about the original trilogy, was that the second film was such a dark twist. And I felt like, you know, Attack of the Clones, like, it really had a great setup for that, but the way they left it, like, open-ending the way they did, with just Yoda going, "Begun, the Clone Wars has," is like, really, that's supposed to be
I don't
big
know,
dark?
That last shot of, like, the Star Destroyer, the predecessor to the Star Destroyer's taken off, that always seemed pretty dark to me.
Yeah, but it wasn't like Han Solo being taken away in carbonite, and we don't know if he's actually going to live or not, kind of dark. I mean,
true.
When I watched that, like, that... The only other movie that I've had that kind of a feeling for is Fight Club. When they end of that, and you're just like, "Oh my god, the bad guys are winning! What?" Like,
yeah,
like that was the thing that it was. Just, it was never done before, and I was expecting that in the last prequel. And so it's going almost like, well, if they do it again, like, they would almost have to do it now, because you can't see the second trilogy ending on a dark note. I mean, that would almost be tragic. Like, you can't and the third film of the last three on the bad. No, it has to be this next one. It's got to be the darkest one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No,
well, you're assuming that they're going to stop at 9.
Oh, yeah.
They may not.
I mean,
that's true. But I mean, I thought they talked about the saga films only being 9 at this point.
Until we see the box office for episode 8, and then they'll say, you know what? 12 sounds like a nice round number, says some Disney executive.
Yeah, well, most of those old serials did go 12 episodes, and George had mentioned that once. So I definitely think they're going to go to 12.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Our next story begins with the headline. The headline, rather, begins with the three words that were inevitable to say on this podcast. In fact, I'm surprised we've lasted this long without saying these three words. So for the next story, Pablo Hidalgo tweets... Mark, you want to finish off the headline and introduce this story for us? Pablo Hidalgo tweets.
Pablo Hidalgo, he tweets that Han Solo just might be force sensitive.
Wait, what?
That was a hit the brakes, do a 360, come back and look at that garage sale again. I think they have an R2 in the front yard kind of statement. Like when he said that. I like the way he starts it, though. He goes, one, heads incoming tweet flood full of unsolicited views about the Force. 14 or 15 tweets, bear with me.
So I love like, that he lets you know, though. It's 14 or 15, yeah. So you can decide up front whether to follow the trail.
Yeah, like, how hungry am I? I may need to stop at about 7. You know, that might be a full belly here. I don't need any more Force philosophy. But, yeah, I mean, it was one of those things that when he starts going, you're just like, okay, where's he going with this? You know, a colleague of mine stated recently that everyone has and uses the Force, which raises questions in some, but it's nonetheless true. Wait, what? And that's something I've always felt because, you know, legends played around with the living force and the unifying force. And we found out that everyone's connected to the living force and that even if you're not attached to the living force, you're still attached to the unifying force because we're all united in some way. Just how Yoda says that everything Luke is connected, the tree, the rock, the ship. Well, they don't live, but they're connected to the force. So that kind of makes sense, right? Three, the force is life. If you ever felt a moment of connection with another on your world or in your world, you're using it. That's the idea. So four, you can just believe in it, but you still have it. I'm sure Obi-Wan would attribute Han's amazing piloting and quote-unquote luck to the Force. Han wouldn't, which is another thing that Legends has ran with. His luck, in quotes, is an element of the Force. Like in role-playing games, that is an element of it, which is his fifth one. For gamers, note that I think every incarnation of the RPG gave Force points to everyone, regardless of, quote, Force sensitivity. You know, and that's one of those things that when we got the prequel trilogy, George gave us midichlorians. We found out that there were, like, levels to Force sensitivity. Like, hey, there's a threshold. But Pablo even goes on with that, you know, ergo, we would cite in Bruce Lee, you know, in our world, he would be someone more attuned to the Force than most, hence his remarkable abilities. Seven, it's not just physical abilities. Those who can sway large numbers of people, for good or for bad, are tapping into a connectivity. Eight, I see the case made that exceptional minds are all kinds. You know, we've got Einstein, Hawking, we've got Newton. They're all tapping into a world that most can't see. Nine, he goes on, I think people understandably got caught up in the whole midichlorian thing. They thought you must have X number of middies to use the Force. And the X number of middies was more the stronger you were. That was how Lucas always explained it, was they were how you listened to the Force and how you were able to exert your control, and they were what gave you the strength in your control. But he's saying you don't have to worry about that, because number 10, he says, the middie prerequisite was to enter the prequel era Jedi Order. Okay, it's to get into the Order. It's a rather soulless way to look at potential by narrative design, which is interesting. 11, he goes on, the prequel Jedi have systemized their methods at the expense of spirituality and intuition. They're more an order than Jedi, which is, again, one of the flaws of that order, which goes so great into the mythology of everything that's going on with the fall of the Order itself. 12, he goes, characters like Jocasta Nu, Ki-Adi Mundi, they embody that. Others like Dooku, Qui-Gon, and Anakin, they don't. 13, but there's more to the Force than just Jedi/Sith, which hopefully we'll learn more in Rebels Season 3 with Bendu being added to it. There's more to potential than middies. He says, just like there's more to genius than grades. All right, that's about enough food for thought with the Force. It's maddening non-observations about Snoke as requested. He's about to return to. But that was one of the things that, like, you know, me and Bruce were like, whoa, wait, what? Like, that could be huge, you know, if they decided to change it and be like, oh, yeah. Han's Force sensitive. I mean, Legends played with Kit Fisto taking some clones and teaching them some techniques, some meditative exercises that would allow them to eventually open their awareness to a point where they could almost feel the Force, not quite like the Jedi, but it hinted at that with enough exercise, one could eventually grow their Force potential. And then they also played in Legends like the ability that everybody stopped using the Force became unleashed, hence Starkiller was able to use it up and things like that.
I loved that.
Kyle Katarn wouldn't use it for a while, or Kyle Katarn, I ticked somebody off, I know.
Somebody's yelling at their iPod.
Yeah, he stopped using the Force for a while, and then he had to retrain himself all over again. Like, he lost his connection to it because he let it go stagnant, which was also another theory that a lot of the Jedi, they went into hiding and, you know, slowly lost their abilities because they didn't practice them. So those are things that, you know, as we move forward in canon, it's like, it's as Sam said, you know, it's the same old thing. What was in Legends doesn't have to come over. They can change it and roll with it in different ways. And we have examples of different ways that they roll with it. So I'd be curious to see if they decided to do something like that, where we did find out, yeah, every single person is force sensitive to a degree, because Legends never said that. They always said everyone had the Force, but you had to pass a certain level to be force sensitive and be able to interact with the Force. And that was where the midichlorians came in. But Pablo
his midichlorian count is
not
off the charts. Yeah, like,
what was that?
Oh, I was just quoting the Phantomist. His midichlorian count is off the charts. In fact,
yes,
like what? There's like a threshold too. Like there's a minimum viable midichlorian count, right?
Well, it was one of those things that was weird to me, because they take a blood sample from Anakin, and based off of one cell in that blood sample, there is a number that they use, and they're like, oh, well, his number is off the chart. Well, that means he's going to be super potential. And it's like, okay, well, if it's based off of one cell, then what happens if you chop off a bunch of body parts then? Do you still have the same potential, but you've now locked your overall strength and you've got to build back up to it? Which was something I always thought happened with Vader. You know, you had this guy that had all this mass potential to be, you know, utilized, but Obi-Wan comes and chops off thousands of these midichlorians in these cells. So while he still has that same, you know, original cell that they were looking at, oh, he's got all this potential, his overall use of it has been diminished in some way. He's got to work his way back up. But
because he's more machine than man, and if he's less man, he's less strength in the Force, right?
So he would, in theory, have less midichlorians. Even though he has the same amount of potential, he has less cells and less midichlorians overall. That would have to impact it, right?
Yeah. No, I think so. I don't know to what extent, but this is sort of the weeds of I don't know. This is sort of the kind of thing that if you get past a certain detail, that I don't know, it becomes almost semantic at some points, right? But it is a fascinating. I'm just fascinated that he was willing to address this in such detail. That's pretty cool.
Here's my question: why? Why did he feel it necessary to bring this up now?
It's 13. But there's more to the Force than just Jedi and Sith. And I've been saying this for a while. I mean, Legends, the other element was the Mandalorians. And the Mandalorians were always a huge presence, whether it was in the KOTOR era or even in the Legacy.
To answer...
on during the Empire.
To answer your question, Bruce, I think... I'm guessing, but I think the most likely answer is that the Force... Oddly enough, because Rogue One's going to be a military movie, but I think the Force is going to be a part of the film that that actually sort of not redefines but undefines the Force. The fact that they use the quote "All is as the Force wills it," I think that they're really going to try to reestablish the mystery of the Force, and they're going to take Rogue One as the opportunity to do that, which would hence why. Pablo would say something like this, because of course they're smack dab in the middle of production.
That Jerusalem aspect, the aspect of multiple religions, you know, the Jedi and the Sith are in a sense seen as religions. We're going to learn that there's more to the Force than just Jedi. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we get that as a line from somebody besides the Bendu in Rebels season 3, which is where I would naturally go. But yeah, that makes sense. Actually, Rogue One doing that with that place as a setting, perfect time to slide something like that in.
Yeah.
Well, I also think with episode 8,
that's small too.
I think it supports episode 8 too, because the whole time since I've seen The Force Awakens, I thought Rey is probably more than likely Luke's daughter. But in the past month, I've now have changed my opinion.
Oh.
And I don't want to get in a huge discussion, but I don't think she's a Skywalker, because I believe that Disney and Lucasfilm do not want to portray Jedi who are strong in the Force have to be a Skywalker. Have to be from that lineage. And so I think they want to bring back that mystery that anybody could be strong in the Force. If you believe in yourself, if you have it in you, you could be that. You don't have to be a
Skywalker. It's the Disney way, right?
Yes.
If you believe.
Well, it's also a Legends thing. I mean, think about it. You had Karan Horn. You had Cam Solsar. You had other Jedi that were prominent that Luke found right away that were a big part of his order. Kip Duron. You know, I mean, Rey could be the Jaina Solo minus the family connection, because Jaina was the Sword of the Jedi. She was a huge, you know, she was a wrecking ball of her own. You know, she had her own following. But I think that could be something we could see where she's kind of like an Ezra-type character, although I would be happy to see that there's an actual family connection to Ezra. Or, you know, like Legends had Zane Carrick, you know, which was another character that I was always hoping that they would tie in family-wise, that I've always hoped that we had more family lines than just the Skywalkers and Solos.
Yeah, no. You make a good case, Bruce. You make a good case. I think, man, see now, but I kind of want her to be a Skywalker. but you don't
well,
always.
Actually, I have to admit, I've come up with a new theory in the last few days.
She's a Calrissian.
But I'm not gonna reveal what I'm starting to think now. But then prior to that new theory, I came up a few days ago. I still believe that she may not be a Skywalker. I can just see she was so force sensitive that her parents got scared and abandoned her on a planet because they didn't know what to do with her.
Intriguing. The mystery abounds. I'm waiting for someone. For my family. Wow. That's well said. Now, there's so much to talk about, but we do, for time's sake, gentlemen, we still got like all the John Williams highlights. We got the Rogue One composer controversy. The composer conundrum, if you will. The composer contortion. All right, I'm going to stop. And a few more stories, but first, we do. We need to talk a little bit about the people who are making this happen, this very podcast happen, and that's the folks who are supporting us over at patreon.com/StarWarsReport. You too can join the fine crew of people, the community people who actually make this podcast happen each and every week. For example, I'm actually going to highlight one of the patrons this week. This week's shout out goes to patron Jeremy Burtz. He's a long time supporter of us here, and has really, really gone a long way to make us keep the lights on and the RSS feeds running. So thank you so much, Jeremy. And I just wanted to highlight specifically this past week on the Patreon. We drop bonus content. In fact, for everyone who pledges at a certain level, they have access to our bonus content RSS feed, where you can actually just punch that into whatever podcatcher you use and subscribe, and we drop bonus content there just about each and every week. In fact, this past week, we went kind of crazy. I was making up. We missed a week or two there. So this past week, we did some bonus segments that we released to you guys, including the Rogue One marketing, Are They Screwing It Up?, in which we make the case that they're not really... There are shortcomings in the marketing of the Rogue One film. And then that wasn't the only one. We did a whole segment on how podcasting has changed our fandom. And those bonus segments are available to everyone who's supporting us at patreon.com/StarWarsReport. Probably the best one is I just dropped a photo, which you can do. I have the Patreon app, and I can just literally share a photo there. And I just added what I think is the best picture ever taken at a Dragon Con or at a Star Wars convention ever. And it's just a shot of us recording the podcast outside of the Turner's Ted's Montana Grill.
With all the strangest looks on our faces.
Yes, it's hilarious. And I posted that up. So if you would like to support the show and help us do it each and every week, help us with the hosting costs, the ongoing equipment upgrades, and all that stuff. Like the audio recorder we used, the camera we used to shoot the video of those interviews at Celebration. Everything you've heard on the podcast this week is only because we've been able to get this stuff because of you guys who are funding us on Patreon. So every single penny that's pledged goes to the show itself. And if you want to access that bonus content and support the show, we would like to invite you to head over to patreon.com/StarWarsReport, explore some of the different levels that you can support us at. And we do thank you for supporting the program right here. For time's sake, gentlemen, we're going to go straight into John Williams. But I feel like this is a tough one to tackle. The news of the week, of course, is that the composer for Rogue One has changed. This is an exclusive from Hollywood Reporter. But this, I wanted to kind of spin this into a more broad discussion, gentlemen, because as you well know, I am a giant, giant John Williams nerd. I love film score. I love the way John Williams defines characters in the way that no one else has ever done it. And I love the classical inspiration, and we're going to get into all of that in detail with some audio highlights from the John Williams panel at DragonCon that I was fortunate enough to host. But let's start with the controversy, the conundrum, the contortion, if you will, the core issue, the catering of the. All right, I give up. That's as many as I could think of. Alexandra Desplat is out. Michael Giacchino.
I think.
We have to decide this now. I think Giacchino is the right one. We'll stick with. I'll say Giacchino. Bruce, you say Giacchino, and Mark, you say Giacchino, and that way we'll be.
I say tomato. You say tomato.
So Alexander, as we know, Alexander Desplat was originally slated to score the movie. He has worked with Gareth Edwards before on the Godzilla movie. And he has a kind of a different style than Michael Giacchino, but Michael Giacchino's taking over. Of course, as you guys well know, maybe some of you guys don't, but if you're wondering, well, who is Michael Giacchino? What can we expect? He, of course, is the composer behind, working with J.J. Abrams, the Star Trek reboots, a ton of Pixar films like The Incredibles and Inside Out, and, of course, my favorite, Up. And Ratatouille,
Jurassic World, Inside Out, Zootopia, Star Trek Beyond. I mean, this guy's got movies for days that I recognize that I love the scores. I think they made the right choice. Desplat has a style that, honestly, I wasn't sure how we were going to go with it. And now I'm like, you know, I listened to the ones and stuff. I listened to the video that you put in there. And everything about what Michael brings to the table, I feel like it.
Well,
is
and we're gonna get to it, sir, because as you know, Rogue One underwent reshoots. Different reports as to how extensive they were. Hollywood Reporter's stating they're pretty extensive, with of course writer Tony Gilroy taking on the filmmaker role. That's kind of the most extreme version of the rumors as far as the reshoots. But it altered the filming schedule and basically meant that Alexandria couldn't do it. And in fact, Michael Giacchino did tweet out like a big congratulations. Not a congratulations to himself. A big thank you. That's the word I was looking for. Support.
Wait. How does shifting the dates make it so the composer suddenly can't do it?
I can answer your question.
Oh, good.
Because it's literally according to the rumors and according to Michael Giacchino himself on Twitter, it's just a schedule conflict. Like, he just couldn't do it. You've got another contract. When they shifted the dates, you just can't do it anymore. And like a lot of these working composers, like they're super busy. Like if it takes you, 10, 12 weeks to do a score and you're doing several scores in a year, like you can only do so much. So, in fact, Michael Giacchino very graciously, said as much and said, he was grateful for the opportunity and said, sometimes just schedules conflict.
But they shifted it forward. I thought they shifted it back.
I think the reshoots shifted the scoring date back. Oh. Yeah, the film release date is still the same.
He's in a room at that time, and he has to look at the scenes, right? That's what makes it. Because I'm like, okay, if you say you're gonna do it by like say, for example, we're gonna say you're gonna do it in November, right? And they're like, oh well, we move things out, so you got more time to do it. Oh well, now I got more time. Pee off! I ain't doing it. That didn't make sense, but okay, that makes more sense. He's just like, now I can't be in that room at the end of November, guys. I can only do it in the first. Okay.
So now I want to break in though. Like that's the official story, the unofficial story. That's the Hollywood Reporter. What you guys here listening to the Star Wars Report need to know.
We're Paul Harvey, this sucker, right now, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Is that these two composers, and again, that guys, it's beginning to fit into a narrative here with Rogue One. These two composers have very, very different styles. And Alexander Desplat is more dark, a little more experimental, and doesn't have quite the punchy character theme element that Michael Giacchino has, which is, of course, much closer to the John Williams score. So I think this fits directly into the narrative that when it came to the reshoots, and again, guys, I'm not the guy raising, calm down, stop your emails. I'm not the guy raising the alarm saying the sky is falling because they reshot. I'm just saying there's always a reason to do reshoots. And here, the reason sounds like that they wanted to Star Wars-y it up a bit, right? Like maybe it was a little too much of a war film. So now we're shooting for, pun intended, a more traditional feel. And part of that would fit right in with getting Giacchino on board as composer, which, by the way, you know, like if you're Kathleen Kennedy, Bruce, if you're Kathleen Kennedy and you need to make a phone call for, say, hey, we need to punch up the humor, maybe make this feel a little bit more like the original trilogy, maybe not so much, a little less Saving Private Ryan, a little more New Hope. Who do you call? Who literally just did a film that was compared very directly in many cases to A New Hope?
Well, I just want to mention that when they announced J.J. Abrams for Episode 7,
yeah,
I thought, oh my gosh, I hope they get John Williams. But if not, I want it Michael Giacchino, because I've been a big fan of his, especially with the Star Trek soundtracks. And I've been like rooting for him the whole way through. And so when Episode 8 was coming up, I'm like, well, if it's not John Williams, I hope it's Michael. And then when they announced Michael for Rogue One, I'm like, yes. And all the changes that they're apparently making to Rogue One is exactly what I've been saying for the past year or two. And that is, this has to be not a war film in the Star Wars universe, but a Star Wars film that is a war story.
Yes.
And I feel like they went down the road of making a war film and it just didn't quite feel like Star Wars. And they're making it more Star Wars-y.
Yeah.
Now they're putting, like you said, the composer in there that makes more music that sounds like John Williams than the other composer does. And I think,
and
you know, I'm excited about that, but I'm worried too, because it could, you know, it might, when you're coming this late in and you're making these kind of changes, it might not work right.
But it's not too late. Like, here's the ultimate sign that it's okay. Right? If you're panicking, if you're feeling like Bruce, if you're a little worried, a little concerned.
Just a little. Yeah.
Just remember, they haven't changed the date. That would be the ultimate sign. And so I think that they've allowed for the production time to make the changes that they need. And I think that there's still reason to be confident. Because, like you say, if you were just picking the composer, Bruce, like, you would pick Giacchino, right? So
absolutely.
I think it's a good sign. Now, and I'm going to play a little excerpt here just to demonstrate, because Giacchino, he is a thematic composer in a way that Desplat isn't. And I think you guys aren't going to be able to hear it, but I'm just going to play a brief excerpt of the Star Trek theme from Star Trek Into Darkness. Just a brief excerpt here. Here we go. And you hear the build-up and the main theme starting right here. Dun, 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 dun. And you have a very distinct Star Trek theme. Like, it's not terribly Star Wars-y, right? Like, Bruce, you know this, like, but it does, like, if I asked you, Bruce, here, hum the new Star Trek theme, go. Yep. Exactly.
And my kids hear me do that all the time. We have a fan in our guest bedroom that ticks when it's going on. It's like tick, 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 tick. And then when it does it, I go, dun, 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 when it ticks.
It's nice. So true. But like, just to give a brief counterexample, I want to highlight a brief moment of Alexander Desplat's score. I'm going to buzz through real quick here and just say, well, let's take a listen to his Godzilla, because that's, of course, what he worked with Gareth Edwards. Here we go. Very brassy. Very, I mean, kind of horror film, traditional.
Yeah, but I think that's a bad example, because like, of the films that he has on his roster, like, that's the only real action film. I mean, most of his stuff is more romance type music.
Well, yeah, you got like Argo, of course, some of the Harry Potter films, but The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Christ, Guardians was a good one, but like, I feel like Desplat's music takes itself too seriously for what they're trying to do with Rogue One. You know, I mean, like Bruce said, you want to have a Star Wars film, that is a war film, you know, not a war film that's set in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I think that's what you have is you have, it's kind of like Schindler's List, you know, like Desplat was the little girl in the red dress, you know, it was like drawing attention to the fact that like it didn't quite fit in.
Yeah, I could see that. I think, and film music has really been a big topic of conversation recently. There have been a series, there's a video that came out, and I stuck a link to a Polygon story that actually has that has this video and another video in it talking about how the Marvel scores have been sort of a topic of conversation because of this guy's video where he talks about how temp scoring and how blockbusters are using each other's temp scoring really sort of diminishes the melodic quality of film scores recently, particularly like with the Marvel films, how it's very difficult to really hum any of the themes. There are themes there, but they're never really at the front of the mix, sound mix. They're never really highlighted in the way that a lot of films are. And so the idea of an operatic film score has kind of died in recent years, particularly with Marvel films. And I agree with it. Like, and I love the music anyway. I listen to the soundtrack, so I can hum some of the themes. But like, if I were to say hum the Captain America theme, which I told Bruce to do in the pre-show, he couldn't do it. And I think, and he does some great comparison of like how similar some of these blockbuster scores are. So obviously that's kind of more Marvel. We're not going to get into the weeds, but it's an important thing to, I think, recognize that that's a big part of film scoring recently. And I'm such a big nerd about it that I think that's an important thing to avoid. And I think if there's one person who can do it, it's Michael Giacchino. Now, speaking of film music, gentlemen, I'm so excited to present some elements of the maestro, John Williams, because as I've teased it long enough, let's get straight into it. Shall we dig in to some John Williams awesomeness?
Yes, let's, please.
All right, here we go. This, of course, I was very, very fortunate to host a Music of Star Wars and John Williams panel at Dragon Con just 2 weeks ago, and it was an absolute blast, and I really had a lot of fun highlighting some of the classical influences and then some of the early film influences of John Williams and some of like where Star Wars score came from. And then of course we broke down a couple tracks. So I have a couple clips to highlight for you guys and share the experience with you. I'm going to say it right now. Actually, I don't have time to play the full panel audio on the program here. It's a full, every bit of an hour. There is one place you can hear it though, because that's next week, or as you're listening to this podcast, this week's bonus content on Patreon I'm just literally gonna put the whole hour of audio for you guys who are supporting us on Patreon. But you're gonna hear the meat of it here. And I've taken the time to cut out my personal favorite moments and kind of the meat of the panel itself. So let's get straight into it. Doesn't really need that much introduction. This is me right at the beginning introducing the panel. Let's take a listen.
Wait for it. There he is, the maestro, John Williams. And surprise, in the back. No. I wish. No, talk about like a Dragon Con surprise Monday morning. No, I'm not going to do that to you guys. In fact, I'm just going to start immediately by saying hi. I'm Riley. I'm addicted to John Williams. No, I'm actually very excited to be here. I've got a great panel that I'm going to introduce to you guys in just a second. But I actually want to start off on the next slide, please. I actually want to talk about film score with you guys because I feel this is important to just set the stage, because the man who is John Williams is sheer greatness and also a man who understood and stood on the shoulders of giants. This attractive young man here is Hector Berlioz, or Berlioz, depending on the way you pronounce it. And he was a protege of probably a better-known composer, Ludwig van Beethoven. Now, Berlioz composed a symphony, and it was called the Fantasy Symphony, because I will not attempt to pronounce and butcher Symphony Fantastique. All right, I just did. But what's important to recognize about classical music and about understanding John Williams' work is the fact that he defined character themes for film. But there were film scores before film scores.
And this man was one of the people who introduced them, and they were called program symphonies. You would be able to attend a symphony and read and follow along with a story that's told as the symphony performed. And so, if I could actually cue the first piece of audio, it's going to be Berlioz's First. I want you guys to think about this for a moment. He wrote an entire symphony because he went and saw a Shakespearean play in Paris and loved the actress. And so he wrote a symphony about her, which, by the way, pro tip, guys, that's a great way to do it. Now, what does this have to do with John Williams, you ask? Well, he composed not one, not two, not three, not four movements, the traditional classical symphony. He composed five. And throughout each of these five movements, you hear a character theme. And it floats in and out through this traditional symphony. You could mistake it for Beethoven if you're a classical music nerd. But you would keep hearing this theme repeat throughout the symphony. If we could have that first audio, please. A very cheerful, lilting, dancing theme. It's the lover's theme. She's never named in the symphony. But here it is. Dun, 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 dun. It's hard not to hum. And this may sound familiar to you. The use of the woodwinds. The repeating, lilting flavor is the kind of thing that you might hear. Well, you might hear it in like an Ewok march or something. Of course, you have to have the brass. There it is. Thank you. Now, what's important to recognize about this is that that theme recurs throughout the entire symphony. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a leitmotif, a small recurring theme that defines a character. And years later, these classical composers would inform people like, that we know now, Hans Zimmer, right? We have, whether it's James Horner, some of our classical composers we love, and of course, the man who is the inspiration of those two I just mentioned, Mr. John Williams. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Music of Star Wars and John Williams panel. Let's get started.
There it is. That was the beginning. That was so much fun.
And that's just the beginning.
That's just the beginning. That's what, by the way, I think I'm the first person ever to do a cold open at a panel. Because then I introduced the panel after that.
Like, that's an appetizer, man. You just whetted my whistle. That's all. I'm ready to devour now.
I know. I can't add much to it other than I could literally tell that story in the 20-minute version because I'm a giant music nerd. But that's the short version of what... I mean, that's seriously like a program... Who knew that? Like, a program symphony, like where there were character themes long before movies were ever made. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that Williams does so well. So speaking of which, that kind of transitions into a later era... The early film era. These are the films that inspired George Lucas and John Williams. The big score era of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. There were some big inspirational film scores that a lot of people don't really know about that informed John Williams. Let's take a listen to clip number two.
And definitely, speaking of that era of filmmaking, I think we're ready. Well, let's execute. I want to do a few examples. So think of a swashbuckling film. This came out in 1940. This is the height of World War II. And the Seahawk. You hear the big brass. You hear a very triumphant theme celebrating the heroes. Man, I love the soundtrack so much.
You can hear a lot of John Williams' later stuff in this, like his Olympics fanfare. There's a lot of that in there. Even the NBC Nightly News theme, a little bit of that in there.
Yes, that's an excellent point, because there are so many parts of this score that does define that. Or you might have something much more dramatic and sweeping, like, for example, Lawrence of Arabia. I don't want to talk right now. It's so good. But and in fact, and I want to encourage the panelists, because we do have a lot of audio today, if there's something that you recognize particularly, and especially as we get ready to do Q&A, that you hear in John Williams, that's exactly what we're here to talk about. But yes, Lawrence of Arabia, the sweeping epic film.
Little bit of Raiders, you can hear.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's excellent.
Makes sense given the setting of both those films.
Excellent. And then, of course, one of my favorite films of all time, The Great Escape, starring the inimitable Steve McQueen. He was a cool Harrison Ford before Harrison Ford. He's awesome. All right, let's hear it. Now, this is going to be familiar as you hear that march.
You see, like, Finn bebopping around. And
I feel
like Stormtrooper duties.
And that's The Great Escape. So these are some examples of some of the prior history and the fine tradition of film score. And I think it's important to recognize, because I think for a lot of Star Wars fans, especially the generation that's here, the kind that we're attending cons, we know each other on Twitter, right? This generation of Star Wars fans, I feel like sometimes there's a generational gap where we don't recognize some of the influences, the mythological and, of course, thematic when it comes to music influences.
Bruce, how many of those scores had you ever really heard before or thought of before?
The scores that you played at that panel, which I was in attendance of, I had not listened to those scores before, especially when compared to Star Wars. So this was something new for me.
Okay, see that, and that's what I was hoping for both you guys listening to the podcast and for those who are in attendance, because it is. It's an element of film making history that I think is often overlooked, because you have to appreciate what influenced Williams, I think, to really appreciate Williams himself.
Craig should go to George Lucas, too, because he brought some of those elements to John, saying, this is kind of what I want.
Yeah. You were saying, Mark?
Oh, it's time to bring Gavin down here so you can finally educate him. Who is John Williams? I'm still like, are you kidding me?
And you've heard some of the panelists briefly. I want to do say a big thank you at this point to Sarah Dimster and Thomas Harper, who are panelists on the panel, and they were great. And then of course Brian Larson from Tashi Station was absolutely incredible, and Kelly, aka Yoda Princess, they were all panelists. Brian was nice enough to actually to set up and record the audio, which is why you guys are hearing it. So a big thanks to them over at Tashi Station for doing that. And we're gonna dig in a little bit more. We got three more. I want to touch. We're not gonna have time to go through all of the themes and stuff that we highlighted, but I do want to touch on the binary sunset, but not the binary sunset that you're thinking of. Now I want you to imagine, though, what was the first version of that theme. Let's take a listen. Now, imagine him walking up the steps, contemplating. I really don't want to be here one more season. But this version is not the classic one. In fact, what you're hearing right now, you would be seeing the shot of him looking off into the desert. This was the first recording and the first intended theme. It's mysterious. And in fact, even towards the end, turns foreboding.
And then it cuts. Reminds me of? It reminds me a lot of Ray's theme, actually.
Actually, yes. That's a good point. But that's an example. That's was the first version. Now, just imagine the difference of watching the film now. That was the first edition, and that's where creative geniuses like Williams and George Lucas needed to collaborate to really make sure that this theme had a much different.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. That the difference there, if you have that alternate track, I think it was in like a four disc release from like the late 90s or early 2000s. It's so different. And so the Star Wars score wasn't just magically pulled out of the air, and it took a lot of experimentation and contemplation to get it right. Brian had an excellent point
to deliver on the Binary Sunset itself. But which, of course, after you hear the alternate version, guys, we got to hear the actual real thing. Here we go.
So in listening to this track, as opposed to the initial version, this is where the collaboration between the film score and the filmmaker is so key. Because at some point, George Lucas and John Williams sit down and say, you know, this scene needs something different. It needs something that feels more Campbellian. And this just embodies that Hero with a Thousand Faces theme. And it just, it works on so many levels.
Oh, no. And what else we've discovered just during this panel, Brian, is that whenever you have an excellent point to make, it's so much better if you have John Williams backing you up.
I just need that following me everywhere.
I know.
It's,
yeah.
It's so true. Ah. I should have queued it up right now just so that I could have it. That's an excellent point. There was one more. A lot of you guys may know this, but of course, let's not forget the Emperor's theme, which is present in a very unusual place in The Phantom Menace.
Kind of dark-sidedness.
But the important theme, and I will probably do this several times and apologize for the bad humming and bebopping, but again, let's be honest, we all do it with John Williams. And that is, you hear the do-do-do, do-do-do. Exactly. Thank you, Brian. You didn't leave me hanging. I like that. I wouldn't be the only one up here. I appreciate it, sir. But that exact notation is something that you'll recognize reflected, because many would call Palpatine, old Sheev, Sheev McPalps, as I call him, and he may be the Phantom Menace. In fact, let's take a listen to this little musical cue and see if you guys recognize something. Oh, this is going to be Augie's Municipal Band, yeah. A very cheerful ending, you thought. Right? It's the end of the Phantom Menace. Let's hear it loud. Let's celebrate with the Gungans.
Here's what happens when you put something in a major key that should be in minor.
Ooh. So what you're hearing here is the major key version to the exact note of the Emperor's theme. That's right. While you were watching Jar Jar Binks dance around and you were thinking, wait, what did I just see? All right, cheap Phantom Menace joke. You were... exactly, Jar Jar is the Sith. No, I think that's the fundamental takeaway from that final
scene. Hashtag it.
In fact, I can't beat that. But it's these are like who? Let's show hands. Who? Because we have a lot of John Williams nerds in here. Like who recognized that? Or is this a first? So we've had a few, but who's this a first? You're like, wait, what's that in the Phantom Menace? Okay. And you're like, well, I just didn't listen after I read the Qui-Gon spoiler on the last track.
So, yeah, there was like probably a good 2/3 of the room hadn't recognized that. And yeah, no, that's that was so much fun. So much fun to do. Guys, I can't believe I got to do that. And it was a packed room. It was so much fun. I was honestly probably the most fun panel for me from Dragon Con.
I would say so too, because you know, most times when these panels, people are sitting at a table, but Riley, you were standing the whole time with the mic and you were working the room.
I was trying to entertain the people.
Yes.
Speaking of entertain the people, ladies and gentlemen, let's get into it. It's time for Boba's Bounty.
It's worth a lot to me. As you wish.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Each week, we like to highlight something we've watched, read, consumed, touched, felt, or otherwise experienced in the world of Star Wars and that galaxy far, far away. It's Boba's Bounty. Let's kick off what we've been doing in the last week, Star Wars-wise. Mr. Herleman, lead us on.
Well, today I was playing Star Wars Battlefront with Nathan P. Butler while we were waiting for Michael Morris of Cloud City Casino to join him so they could talk. And while we were playing, we were doing the free – there was a free demo thing for Solstice. I was playing on that. And one of the people were asking, you know, why Nynub is a ground trooper in Battlefront when he was a pilot. And, you know, I pointed out that, well, clearly now in the new canon, he's a soldier first, as we see in Battlefront, the book. You know, he created a cell on Solstice. We've seen him on the ground more often than not. In fact, it kind of leads you to wonder if the rebels didn't trust Lando Calrissian and they sent him along just in case they needed to take Lando out. Of course, which was something that made Nathan go, wait, what? Like, you know, it was a total ponder that we just had and kind of ran with for a minute of like, you know, nobody really trusted Lando, and that's the real reason why Nine Nub was along.
Nice, nice. That's I did not know that. I did not know that he was a ground trooper first. Excellent, excellent.
He wasn't until just recently. Like, now all the new canon stuff, they're showing him on the ground all the time. And then, of course, the game has him being utilized 24-7. But it makes sense because that's his role now. He's, in a sense, a Leia Organa style, you know. Leia's group was a small rebel cell. That's why they had all the X-Wings. Nine Nub was another group. Eventually, these type of groups start collaborating, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then eventually we see what we see in Return of the Jedi.
Nice, nice, nice. All right, I'll give one, and that is available now. My Boba's Bounty, available right now at StarWarsReport.com, and we will link to it in the show notes, is a video that I cut together. It's a live reaction to the Star Wars Rebels Thrawn teaser trailer that was released a couple weeks ago during Dragon Con, which Henry Gilroy brought along and showed the crowd for the first time. And so, like, all the hosts of the panel on Star Wars Rebels, including you, Mr. Bruce Gibson,
yes,
all got off the stage to watch this teaser. And I actually shot video of it, and I even have the nice little picture in picture. And you get to see Bria and Bethany and Nancy and you and the back of Bruce's head.
It's so lovely too, the back of my head.
react live to the Star Wars Rebels Thrawn trailer, and this is a real reaction because they didn't know I was shooting it. Haha! So none of this fake crap.
Yeah, I had no idea that you did this until afterwards, and you told us. But then, you know, it's so funny to watch it because Bria is just classic in her reactions.
Oh yeah, no. And so you guys have to see this video. It's amazing. It's just a minute long, and it is in the show notes for episode 240. Also, if that's too hard for you to remember, here's what you want to do. Go to youtube.com/StarWarsReport. And of course, it's the most recent video on there right now. So check it out. And while you're there, go ahead and subscribe. Because we got some cool stuff, like, I don't know, video interviews with Star Wars Rebels cast coming up on our YouTube channel. So again, youtube.com/StarWarsReport. And I just looked at it. That just became our most viewed video on all of YouTube. I just noticed that. maybe we need more reaction videos. But yeah, seriously, like,
You've been watching it too many times.
Yeah, I was going to say, at least a couple hundred of those views are all me. So that is My Boba's Bounty. Bruce, you done anything Star Wars recently?
Yes. You know, now that you've been speaking about John Williams music.
Yes,
yes. Yeah, went to the Verizon Wireless Amphitheater in Alpharetta, Georgia, for an outdoor venue of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra performing John Williams music, and especially music from Star Wars. And you know what, Riley? I think you were there.
I was. How about that? You were there. I was there. John Williams was there. No, I wish.
Yeah, that would have been cool. I was really hoping.
Dude,
my
favorite part.
Walk out.
My favorite part of that, because I'm gonna now co-opt your Boba's Bounty. My favorite part of that was just hearing the Force Awakens themes performed
yes.
live. That was amazing.
Yeah, they started with the Jedi Steps and went right into the finale where it has all the different themes from Rey's theme to the First Order, everything in there, and it was just incredible.
Yeah.
Wait, they started with the end of the movie?
Well, they first start off with, actually, they played the 20th Century Fox fanfare.
Yes.
And then they went into the main theme of Star Wars, and then they went right into Duel of the Fates, Anakin's theme, the Imperial March, and then Jedi Steps into the finale music
which hit up pretty much all the big themes from TFA, which is great.
It did.
Nice. Honestly, my favorite was like the Fiddler on the Roof performance. Like, it was all kind of, it was like the Olympic fanfare, Fiddler on the Roof, Harry Potter. What else? There
the
was
Superman
so much.
March, which is one of my favorites.
Oh, Jurassic Park.
Yes.
Yeah, it was so much fun.
And then the encore was the Raiders March from Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones.
Yes. Ah, that was so much fun. That was great. I'm glad that there's more of an Atlanta crew. Because coming up like this weekend, right, is the Force Awakens at the same location, right?
That's right. Yeah, we talked about
that. Friday?
Friday, yeah.
I gotta get off work.
Yeah.
Hang on, I gotta text some people here. Sorry, I'll be right back. That's what I get for
I do it. He's like, okay, we'll put you on hold. I'm gonna text people right now. Is that your on hold music?
I was gonna say, yeah, sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. I just got really excited about, we're gonna go see The Force Awakens this weekend in a big outdoor arena, the same one. So that's like a preview of probably what next week's Boba's Bounty will be. But Star Wars is like, it's like lifestyle. It's a lifestyle now. It's not just us hanging out on the internet.
I mean, it's everywhere. It really is. And the other thing about the concert was that Bethany was there and she baked cookies and we got to eat cookies. It was good.
I forgot about that. Those are so good. I feel like, you know who I feel like?
They kind of disappeared.
Who would...
I had a couple and then they were gone.
All right, fine. I did it. It was me.
I turned them.
I couldn't help it. Come on.
My wife was there. I said, watch Riley. He's going to eat the rest of the cookies.
You did not. You did not.
I did. And then afterwards, I'm like, oh, by the way, what did happen to the cookies? And she said to me, I think you're right. He did eat them all.
It was a lot of cookies. It was an uncomfortable amount of cookies. You know,
I'm that way with gummies.
I feel like Shmi Skywalker was a great chef. I bet she made great cookies. I feel like she would put them out and then like Kitster and Wald and Anakin, the whole gang would be able to get them.
Mm. You made me think of something, Riley. What would Shmi Skywalker do when Anakin didn't want to eat his mashed potatoes? What form of discipline did she do? Because clearly that boy went bad.
I have no idea. I feel like Anakin Skywalker was... If there's one thing the Phantom Menace taught us, let's be honest. Anakin Skywalker's the kind of kid, he'd eat his mashed potatoes. Right?
It didn't teach us that single mothers have to watch out that their children might fall to darkness, right? That wasn't an old theme.
I'm the only human...
They had to have been instant mashed potatoes.
I'm the only human who can do it.
And he's like, I hate it, Mom. I hate it.
Potatoes don't grow Tatooine. They got to be instant mashed potatoes, and you have to go to the moisture evaporators to get your water to make them. They're not that good on Tatooine.
You know, that would make Top Ramen like a prize dish with all the water you have to use.
Yeah.
You know, this discussion means that we're ending the show pretty soon here.
It ended 5 minutes ago, gentlemen. No, we can't end the show because we have feedback for you guys. We're running over, but what is time? What is time? Time is an artificial construct.
Time? This is no time to talk about time. We don't have the time.
We carry on into the feedback segment. 4 more years. All right. We have an email from Jeremy. He's speaking of which, he's our featured patron this week. Jeremy says, I just listened to the most recent show and heard the news that made my heart skip a beat for the George Lucas Museum. I felt like Darth Vader at the end of Revenge of the Sith. It would have been so convenient for me since I have relatives in Wisconsin and I could fly to Chicago and stay there for a while. I could tell Jeremy's thought this out. And you guys mentioned the leaked photo. Oh, and you guys also mentioned the leaked photo of Luke Skywalker of his image scan. Remember that? Did you see that, Bruce, when that leaked?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I remember that. That was one of the spoilers I was kind of unhappy that I saw. But yeah, we saw the that leaked image. He makes me seriously wonder. It makes me seriously wonder, rather. Where is this figure, Hasbro? I mean, a question many people have asked many times. Perhaps we'll get one this fall on Force/Rogue Friday. That's from Jeremy, a fine patron supporter of us. Yeah, come on. Where is that figure? I want that figure. That is a figure. That's a figure I'd buy. I don't buy action figures. There's a precious few. The one I did buy the Vader Ahsoka 2-pack for Rebels. That was just, I couldn't pass that up. That was so cool.
Wasn't that? Scan like Luke more white than less the gray that we saw at the end of the episode, because like I would
it
expect
kind of was.
In the episode Jedi Steps Luke to be the Luke figure we're gonna get. I'm honestly surprised we haven't got that, considering, I mean, he's surrounded in a cape. That's perfect for 5 points of articulation. What the heck?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, here it is. I a quick Google image search brought it right up. It is the same, but it looks, it's under bright lights, so it looks whiter than it does in the film. But it is the same. It is the same look. But
dropping has, bro. Come on.
I'm looking at. Yeah, that's a lot of lights around it. That is quite the 3D scan they're doing. In fact, Mark Hamill's kind of looking slightly off to the side, like, "Hey, are you supposed to be taking this picture?" And the answer to
that
question.
That's why the figure hasn't come out yet.
Exactly.
He's looking off to the side in the figure.
And he's glaring silently as well. This email comes from Star Wars Report listener Eric. He says, "Hi, SWR. I've been listening to your podcast special with Steve Glosson." Dude, but one of my favorite episodes ever. He says, "I think a couple of years, I'm a couple years older than Steve, so it's fun to hear others talk about the dark times of Star Wars in the mid to late 80s and the return in the early 90s with Thrawn. I turned 12 in 87, and I remember how, for me, Star Wars was put on the back burner for a few years. All of my toys were put in the attic, and some were even thrown away." Ooh. It's such a common tragedy, too. Every once in a while, I would pull them down for nostalgic reasons and then quickly put them back. I feel like, is there a little guilt? Was there a little guilt there, Eric? You like maybe cast a brief glance to the side to see just to see the vintage Darth Vader and then look away quickly. It's like a bad romance movie. It's like, gentlemen, are you still with me? I just want to make sure.
We are still here.
Oh, okay, just making sure. Skype did a weird thing. Sorry. Back to the email. When Heir to the Empire came out, I didn't learn about it until the paperbacks were released in 92. That's also the first year I started buying comics. I bought the classic Star Wars number one and the reprints of Dark Empire. Dark Empire, by the way, just so good. It's snowballed ever since. I've always felt like I was a bit of an island because I never knew anyone who loved Star Wars as much as me until I started listening to podcasts in 2014. Really enjoyed the episode. Thank you. Eric, thank you. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate you being a part of the Star Wars Report family just by listening, because I feel like we've been so fortunate this year between Celebration and Dragon Con and now, of course, coming up to New York Comic Con. We've been so lucky to meet so many listeners. It's a real thing. Like this Star Wars community, it's a thing, guys. It's great. I love it.
I love Star Wars, but I also love the community almost as much. It just enhances it so much.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I couldn't think of better parting words to end the show. So I think on that note, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to bring episode 240 to a close. Now, here's the thing. We got about 2 minutes or so of we got a couple minutes to give you guys the plugs for this week. And let you guys know where we are on social media and how to stay in touch with us during the week, because it is a community and you can join us and talk to each and every one of us. And I'm going to tell you guys how to do that. I'm also going to say, guys, we almost hit an hour and a half. That's been forever since we did an episode that long. And I had a feeling we had the content to do it, and we did. So it's like, it's like bonus show.
That wasn't enough content. When you think about the stuff that we put on the back burner in the last couple episodes, there's still some great topics to come.
Absolutely. And speaking of great topics, send us an email. I really do want to bring the email portion of the show and highlight that a lot more. And here's how you can do that. Email us. It's StarWarsReport@gmail.com. StarWarsReport@gmail.com. Very easy to remember. Just fire off an email. And you know what? Kind of toss into the subject line, with podcast just somewhere, so that way I know it's from a podcast listener. Believe it or not, considering that email is kind of public online, we get a lot of, and I'm doing air quotes here, advertising offers. So yeah, make sure you denote that you listen to the podcast. I want to bring in emails more and more. So if you have any thoughts or commentary on John Williams or the composer change, are we freaking out for nothing? Are we not freaking out enough? Pablo Hidalgo tweeting of like, this is what we want to do. And speaking of Twitter, like, here's what you want to do. You want to follow us. It's at the Riley Guy. Bruce is at Admiral_Rex. And Mark is at IllogicalRogue2. That's our usernames. All of them are going to be linked in the show notes. You can find them there. And you can find us on Twitter. But if you're on Twitter and you're already following us, There's a favor I'd like to ask. Considering that they both appeared on the top of the show, just go ahead and fire off a tweet to at Sam Witwer and at Tia Sirkar. That's very easy to remember. Tia is spelled T-I-Y-A-S-I-R-C-A-R. And, of course, Sam Witwer, exactly how you would expect it to be spelled. If you fire off a tweet, just say, hey, heard you on the podcast. And that way they know people are listening, because we're going to publish the YouTube videos and the blog and the transcript stuff. I want them to know that that they were on the podcast and that they were appreciated for coming on it. And so if you could do that, if you listened to the show and you enjoyed the interviews, it certainly was. We're very fortunate to have had them on, and I'm just super, 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 I'm just lucky. I'm super, super fortunate to be able to bring those to you guys. So let them know we appreciate them.
I just assumed that they listened to the show.
Actually, with Sam, I wouldn't be surprised.
And again,
with Sam, I wouldn't be surprised. So yeah, that's it, man. What a show. So much to talk about, and there's so much more. We'll be back with you guys next week. We got New York Comic Con coming right around the corner. We're going to be doing wall to wall coverage with you guys. Got some cool plans for that. We'll be announcing those as those details come through. And also, you can find us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/StarWarsReport, twitter.com/StarWarsReport. And then one more. If I could trespass one more for you guys who are listening. If you're listening and you have not left us an iTunes review yet, here's what you want to do. Just go to StarWarsReport.com/iTunes and head straight over there. Leave us a ratings or reviews. It makes a huge difference with the visibility of the show. And we're always looking to expand the tent and invite more people into this community. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. All right, guys. Am I forgetting anything? I think that's it, right? I feel like that's the show.
Yeah, well, I think there's
a little stuttering of the Bothans.
Exactly. Oh, man. Oh, me. Oh, my. All right. That's going to wrap up this episode of the Star Wars Report podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's been episode 240. We're rolling down the train, riding the train to episode 250. Which will be right around the time Rogue One comes out, actually, by the way. Which makes sense, because 200 was when The Force Awakens came out. It's funny how that works. All right. We'll see you guys. May the Force be with you, and many Bothans died to bring you this podcast. Good show, guys. Good show. Good show. Good show. Good show.
Is that you,
Mike?
Brother? Brother?
Brother? Brother? Dude.
Bonus content. Bonus content.
When he mentioned Savage Opress, just in the chat, so you guys know, the private chat on Skype while we're doing the show and we're listening to the interview playback, I'm literally just typing, brother, 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 and then we just get into a competition. Brother? Brother? All right, guys. We'll see you next week.